Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
We'll pick up where we left off. Today is the 5th of October, 2007. We're practically at the end of this seminar on chanting, so there's just some bits and pieces here and there, odds and ends. Gayatri Mantra, we haven't talked about that yet. That's another form of chanting. The last thing we said, I think, was ghosts. And that was where we ended. So, because the Gayatri Mantra, then that's another aspect of chanting. And Prabhupada always chanted his Gayatri Mantra in the morning, right after he brushed his teeth and he was getting ready to go out on his morning walk. So he would normally, just after Mangal Arati, then he would stop his work on his books. Sometimes he would chat for a little while. He would go to the bathroom, wash his face, brush his teeth, and then he'd come back into his sitting room, put on his tilak, and then he would sit and chant his Gayatri Mantra. So that usually took about 5 minutes. And it was just one of those nice things about being with Prabhupada, that you could sit in his room with him and chant your Gayatri with Srila Prabhupada. So he would sit, he always sat very straight, with his back like a rod, and he would chant, and sometimes he would move his lips a little bit whilst he was chanting the mantras, but it would be inaudible, and then you could sit there and chant your Gayatri as well. And I always used to try to time myself to see if I was doing it properly by, you know, ending at the same time Prabhupada did. So that was nice. And noontime he would chant his Gayatri. He would have his noon massage that would go generally up until about 1 o'clock. Then he would take a bath. He'd put on fresh clothing. He'd put on his tilak, and again he would chant his Gayatri. So that was usually around about 1:20, you know, that time. And then after that, then he would have his lunch. Now his evening Gayatri, I actually don't recall ever seeing him chant it. And I presume that he did it in the late at night, after we'd all gone to bed and I'd finished my duties. But of course, anyway, three Gayatris a day, that's the... So at one time, just after I joined Prabhupada, I asked him, we were in Vrindavan, when is the best time to chant Gayatri? Because I'd heard different things. Some people said 6 o'clock in the morning, noontime, and 6 o'clock in the evening. And then other people, they would say, no, sunrise, noon, sunset. So I thought, you know, I'll get it right from Srila Prabhupada. And he said, just after bathing. So he said, otherwise, you know, 6 a.m., noon, 6 p.m., he said, that's all right. But he said also, just after bathing. So then later on, in January of 76, Madhavisa had come from Australia. We were just here in Mayapur. We were going out on our first morning walk. And so Madhavisa asked the same question. So he asked Prabhupada, he said, in the Bhagavatam, you say that we should greet the sun with the verse from the Gayatri Mantra. Does that mean that we should wait for the Gayatri, wait for sunrise to say our Gayatri? Just as the sun is rising, then we should say it then. And Prabhupada said, no, early morning. And then Tamal Krishna Maharaj asked, well, sometimes we take bath before sunrise and we put on tilak. So should the mantra be said at that time after putting on tilak, or should we wait and then say it? And then again Prabhupada said, no, no. And Tamal continues, when the sun rises, after tilak. Prabhupada said, no, tilak should be done after bathing. And Tamal says, then when we should chant the Gayatri, right after? And Prabhupada said, after tilak. Gayatri mantra is the description of the sun. So that was Prabhupada's preferred time. Then immediately after bathing, put your tilak on, sit down, chant your Gayatri mantra. Because most of us don't bathe three times a day. At least when I was traveling with Prabhupada, I did used to bathe three times a day. Early morning, and then again just before I gave him his massage at noon, or 11:30 rather. And then again in the evening at about 6 o'clock we'd take bath again. So it was convenient to do it at that time. But if you're only bathing once a day, then you have to pick your times for your other two gayatris. And another little bit on Gayatri mantras, April the 24th, 1976. In every temple, this was in Melbourne, there's a tape recording of Srila Prabhupada chanting the Gayatri mantra. This is played in the ear of anyone who receives Brahman initiation through the mail. This afternoon, Tusta Krishna Swami, he was the leader of the renegade group in New Zealand, he asked Prabhupada to give him such a tape, but Prabhupada refused. Prabhupada said there was no need of his men in New Zealand to receive Brahman initiation because they're only worshipping pictures and not deities. So he wouldn't give him it. He had told them, you know, if you approve somebody for initiation, I'll do it. I'll take it on your word. But he knew they had this objection. They didn't actually like living in the temple and they didn't like worshipping the deities. They said, oh, this is all for the neophytes. So then Prabhupada told him, what's the use of having the Gayatri then if you're not worshipping the deities? And later on, actually, they did start to build a temple and then Prabhupada consented to give them the Gayatri mantra. And then, I haven't got this here, I'm just going to have to do this off of memory. But in 1977, on February the 14th, we were here in Mayapur, and there was a long conversation that Prabhupada had about Varnashram and the need to introduce Varnashram in ISKCON. So one of the points that he made, because we were, you know, bringing up all the arguments that Prabhupada had given us, you know, that Varnashram is external, devotees don't need to observe Varnashram, etc. And we were even giving some of the quotes from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, and Prabhupada was defeating us. And he made the point, he said, actually, because, you know, we got to talking about, you know, devotees transcendental to the Varnashram system. And then Prabhupada, he said, some of them are not even chanting their 16 rounds. He said, let them all go and live on the farms. He said, if they can't chant, then they should just get first initiation, but no second initiation. So that was his, he was, you know, he was quite aware of what was going on in ISKCON. And he knew that a lot of devotees were struggling to keep up their vows and to keep up their standards of chanting. So he said, there's no need to give them Gayatri mantra. He said, let them just go and live on the farm and work hard, that's all, and just chant Hare Krishna. So that's a couple of things about the Gayatri. Another instruction that I personally received from Prabhupada about chanting, this was on October the 30th, 1977. And Prabhupada, of course, had just returned to Vrindavan for the last 6 weeks that he was with us. I had come to see him in May, late May, when he was in Vrindavan, and at that time then all the GBC had been called because it looked like Prabhupada was going to leave, and Prabhupada said, call all the GBCs. Everybody came there. I got there a little bit late and I stayed for a couple of weeks in early June, and I knew that Prabhupada had a system. He had a permanent secretary, that was Tamal Krishna Maharaj. But I knew he had this system where any GBC could book in for a month and be a visiting GBC secretary. So I, you know, I decided I would book in for October so that I could come back and see Prabhupada. I was, by that time, I'd been sent back to Australia, and Prabhupada made me the GBC there. So I booked in for October, and I booked my ticket for the last day of September. And then, you know, of course, in between time, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, then he flew to London, and he spent Janmashtami and Vyasa Puja at Bhaktivedanta Manor. Then from there, of course, he got sick. There was some minor operation that he had. And then immediately afterwards, he flew back to India. And so at the end of September, when I arrived in India, Prabhupada was in Bombay. So I arrived early in the morning. Generally, those flights get in about 5 or 5.30 in the morning. And I went straight in to see Srila Prabhupada at Juhu Beach. By that time, he'd moved into his new quarters in the towers there on the top floor. And I was quite shocked to see the condition that Prabhupada was in physically. His bodily condition had deteriorated to the point where he couldn't walk anymore. And even to roll over in bed required assistance, what to speak about anything else. So practically his bodily condition, it was just skin and bone. But his consciousness was completely perfect. It was the same Prabhupada, completely undisturbed. And typically the first thing that he asked me when I came in was, how many books are you selling in Australia? And so I gave him a very upbeat report, and he was very happy about that. So then, I settled in. And then the same evening, then we were called into Prabhupada's room. And I think maybe there was 9 or 10 of us. There was Tamal Krishna, Upendra, Abhiram, myself, Brahmananda, Giriraj, Gopal Krishna, and a couple of others. And then the discussion was, should Prabhupada remain in Bombay or should he go to Vrindavan? So Prabhupada put this question. He said, now you all advise me. So we had to say one by one whether we thought Bombay or Vrindavan. So everybody was saying Vrindavan. When it was my turn, because I'd only just arrived that day, then I wasn't quite fully tuned into, what was going on and what the mood was there. So I asked Prabhupada, is it for health or is it for preaching? So Prabhupada said, it is for health. So then I also voted for Vrindavan. Of course, the preaching part of it was that Prabhupada was there in Bombay. They were getting to the final stage of completing the Bombay temple. And it had been due to be opened, actually, sometime during that year. But there was a few delays. And Prabhupada was there. The marble chipping was going on. There was banging and crashing going on all day and practically all night from the workers. So it was a little disturbing. But Prabhupada said, this kind of noise we can tolerate because that's for preaching. But anyway, so then that was the question. The only person that didn't vote for Vrindavan was Gopal Krishna, because he was the GBC in Bombay, and he was a bit concerned that if Prabhupada wasn't personally there, then the work would slow down, and then the temple opening would be further delayed. But anyway, Giriraj, of course, he was the temple president at that time. He also voted for Vrindavan. So that was it. So then I was deputed to fly to Delhi. I either went the same night or the next morning. I have another diary that I kept during that period, and I can't quite remember whether I went the same evening or the first flight the next morning. So my job was to buy a bed and whatever paraphernalia that was necessary and get that set up in Prabhupada's Darshan room in Vrindavan, because there was no question of him being in the back bedroom where he usually slept, because it wasn't very accessible and it was too cold. And also, going up on the roof was not practical. So we decided that we would put a big bed in Prabhupada's Darshan room. So off I went, and then myself, and at that time, the temple president in Delhi was Bhagavata Shraya Prabhu. So it just happened that there was a friend of the temple who was, he had a carpenter's store, and they made modern furniture. So we went off to see him, and he had one bed. And it was the big double bed that you see there in Prabhupada's quarters. So we bought that. I think it cost us 400 rupees. And then we had a mattress made, a cotton mattress, double thickness, so that it would be softer than normal. And then within a couple of hours, the whole thing was shipped out to Vrindavan. Then I rang Tamal Krishna Maharaj in the afternoon. I told him everything's ready. And then that same evening, then Prabhupada and about 40 devotees, they all came from Bombay overnight, and they arrived in Mathura early the next morning. So that was it. Then that was, of course, Prabhupada's last visit back to Vrindavan, and there he stayed. So, of course, there were a lot of things that happened during that month. I won't say all now. But anyway, by the middle of the month, or a little bit earlier, there was a lot of depression that Prabhupada was going to leave at any moment because he was withdrawing. And he was hardly saying anything. You know, sometimes he would call for different devotees, but we were doing 24-hour kirtan. And it looked like he was, you know, just withdrawing externally. But then on the 8th of October, he gave some hints. He told us that Krishna had given him the choice. So Abhiram was in the room at that time, and Prabhupada told him that. So then he came and told that to Tamal. Tamal called the GBC meeting. Then we decided that we should go and petition Srila Prabhupada to stay with us, and that Krishna had given him a choice, so then it was up to Prabhupada whether he stayed or not. So we did that the next day on the 9th of October, and Prabhupada heard everything that we had to say. Kirtananda was the spokesman. And then he kind of gave a yawn. It was very transcendental. He just went, "All right," like this. He just yawned. And as he said, "All right," you know. So that was it. So then the whole mood changed around again. It became very upbeat. Prabhupada immediately said, "If you want me to stay, then you have to look after me and you have to feed me." So immediately somebody brought some strawberries. So he immediately had a bowl of strawberries. He hadn't eaten anything solid for months. He was only living on like this stuff called Complan. It's like a nutritional drink. So that, and sometimes some juice and some Charanamrita. And then just after that, Prabhupada's sister, Bhavatarini, who we used to call Pishima, she arrived. And Prabhupada asked her to cook. Of course, years before, there was always a thing going on where that was her service to Prabhupada. Whenever he would come back to Calcutta and Mayapur, she would come and she would insist on cooking. And the year before, in 76, we had been here, and she was cooking, and then one afternoon Prabhupada got such bad stomach ache. He said, "That's it." He said, "She can't cook anymore, she has to go. You know, tell her to go back to Calcutta." And he called her in, and then they had a big fight. And I was sitting in the room, and Prabhupada was, I was sitting in the corner trying to be inconspicuous. Prabhupada was yelling at her. She was crying. She was, you know, yelling back. Not yelling, but she was defending herself. And Prabhupada was telling her, "No, you go back to Calcutta now," like this. So in the end, she got up and walked out. She's all in tears. And then Prabhupada burst out laughing. And he said, "The problem is," he said, "she thinks that I'm her brother." He said, "Because of this," he said, "otherwise," he said, "I could have done the same thing as a Grihastha, but this is why Lord Chaitanya took sannyas, because these family members, they don't like to take instruction." He said, "Otherwise," he said, "I also," he said, "I took sannyas, otherwise I could have done the same thing without doing that." So that was the kind of relationship, and it had been like that for years. There was always, you know, the servants and cooks were always kind of having to work around Pishima, because she would always insist on taking over the whole kitchen, you know, on the first floor here, and in the Lotus building. Palika told me one time that Pishima locked her out of the kitchen. She wouldn't let her in so that she could cook Prabhupada's lunch. Yeah. So there was that kind of, you know, mood going on. But when she arrived in October, then as soon as she came, Prabhupada, he apologized to her. He said, "Sometimes," he said, "I've heard that they're not allowing you to see me." So, because it was on his instructions. But he said, anyway, he said, "So you forgive me for that." He said, "Now," and then he told the devotees, Bhakti Churi Maharaj and Tamal and a few of us were there. He said, "Now," he said, "you know, she's a Vaishnavi." He said, "Not only is she my sister, but she's my god sister. She is a disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur." So he said, "Whatever she wants to cook, I will eat it. You let her go and cook." So immediately she went straight into the kitchen and she cooked this huge meal. Heavy stuff. She used to cook in mustard oil, mainly. And big, you know, huge, heavy meal. And Prabhupada ate the whole lot. And we were just, you know, completely shocked, you know, considering his condition. But anyway, he did that. So there were some very nice exchanges going on during October. Anyway, so then at the end of October, that was my month was up as the visiting secretary. And it was a bit of a dilemma because, you know, it was hard to say how long Prabhupada was going to be here with us. You know, Giriraj actually had written a very nice poem where he had compared Prabhupada staying in his physical condition at that time to, you know, Hiranyakashipu, how he was able to stay within, you know, just the skeleton of his body, you know, when he was doing his austerities. So he was saying, well, if even a demon can do that, then surely Krishna will allow Srila Prabhupada, you know, to stay, you know, in this body, which is just skin and bones. So Prabhupada liked that, and he said that we should print that in the BTG. So there was that hope, you know, that Prabhupada was going to stay. At the same time, you know, there was all this back and forth going on with the Kaviraj was there, and we tried this Makaradwaj medicine that Prabhupada had dreamed. He had seen a Ramanuja Kaviraj making this Makaradwaj. So we found out a Ramanuja Kaviraj in Delhi and had him make this Makaradwaj. It's a very, very strong medicine. And then we gave it to Prabhupada thinking, you know, because Prabhupada dreamed about this, that this would do something. But it had the opposite effect. It actually made it worse. So there are all these things going on. Anyway, so at the end of the month, I was trying to figure out, you know, should I stay or should I go? And for me personally, in the middle of the month, I was practically alone with Prabhupada one evening. And so I asked him, you know, if you need more help, then I'll be very happy to just stay here and look after you. But Prabhupada told me, he said, no, I want you there for now. Huh? I want you there for now, means Australia. And he said, later on we shall see. So that kind of settled my heart that, you know, if I go back to Australia, Prabhupada wants me there. That's the service that he wants me to do, and he'll be happy with that. So at the end of the month then, it was time to go back. I'd been away a month. We had a lot of things going on. We were trying to buy a new temple in Sydney, and that was just waiting for me to get back. So I talked with Tamal Krishna Maharaj on the late afternoon and asked him what he thought I should do. Should I stay or should I go? If I stay, maybe I'll be here for months. You know, maybe Prabhupada will just kind of continue on as he is and then gradually improve. Or if I go, maybe he'll leave. So then he gave me some nice advice. He said, well, like Sasrup Maharaj and Atreya Rishi, they've made a program. They're going to go for 1 month and come back for 1 month. So they'll go back to their zones for 1 month, then they'll come back to Vrindavan for a month. So why don't you do that? So I thought that's a good solution. You know, go there for 1 month, then after the Christmas marathon, at the end of November, beginning of December, I'll again come back like this. So having decided that, then Tamal Krishna Maharaj and myself, we went into Prabhupada's darshan room there. He was lying on the bed. It was about maybe 7 in the evening. And it was like this. It was kind of semi-dark. We only had dim lights in the room because Prabhupada couldn't tolerate bright lights. He was wearing sunglasses, actually. And he was lying on the bed, and I went round the side right next to him. And then Prabhupada said, yes, what is that? So then I explained that now it was my month was up and it was time to go back to Australia, and I had all this service to do. So I said, but I'm going to come back again next month, and I'll come and go like that 1 month at a time. So Prabhupada listened to what I had to say. It was only a very short exchange. And then he was lying down, then he raised his hand up like this from the elbow, and he just put his hand up like a blessing, and he just said, wherever you remain, chant Hare Krishna. And that was it. So that was my last instruction that I got from Prabhupada personally. Wherever you remain, chant Hare Krishna. Later on I understood the value of that that, of course, you know, in the mid-80s, I'd been in Australia for 7 or 8 years as the GBC there. I always took that was my service for Prabhupada. Then, due to, you know, my own difficulties, I had to give that service up and I moved from Australia. And then I was feeling very great remorse that I couldn't continue with that service. But then I remembered this instruction that Prabhupada never told me, you stay in Australia and chant Hare Krishna. He just said, wherever you remain, chant Hare Krishna. So I think Prabhupada knew something about what was going to come up. So wherever you remain, it means you can't expect to be in the same place, same circumstances your whole life. But wherever you are, you have to just chant Hare Krishna. That's the only instruction. So, anyway, wherever you remain then. Dancing. I said that we would say something about dancing. It's not exactly chanting, but it is a result of chanting. If you chant, then naturally you want to dance. And ISKCON devotees became very well known, you know, for their dancing, very exuberant dancing. but of course, we got that from Prabhupada. And if you look at the films, Prabhupada's arrival in San Francisco in 67, and all the hippies are there, Mukunda was there, he brought all his hippie friends to the airport, and there's maybe 50 or 60 of them there with flowers, and they're all wearing these, you know, wizard robes and all kinds of paraphernalia. And they start chanting, and then right in the airport, Prabhupada puts his hands up and he just starts chanting with them and, you know, dancing with them right there in the airport. So right from the very beginning, that was Prabhupada's mode, you know, dancing and chanting, and he taught everybody to do that. You know, he wasn't, you know, one of these sedate old men, you know. He was a very revolutionary kind of person. So, you know, he didn't care what the surroundings were. If chanting Hare Krishna was going on, that's it. You know, the response is spontaneous. So, March the 14th then, 1976. Some of you may have seen the installation of Radha Gokulananda in London. We showed that the other night. On the video, Prabhupada started dancing. He circumambulated the deities, and then at the end, he very ecstatically started dancing. He put his hands up, one hand, and then the other, and then he started jumping up and down. So this particular day then, here in Mayapur, we were just building up to Gaur Purnima. There was about 500 or maybe 600 devotees from the West. And so Prabhupada had gone down, greeted the deities. He gave his discourse, and during his discourse, Prabhupada told us about bhava, or ecstasy. At the present moment, he said, we have got bhava. I am this, I am that, I belong to this family, I belong to that nation. So bhava is ecstasy, and everyone is overwhelmed with such kind of ecstasy. The politicians, they think that we are simply wasting time in chanting and dancing. So they have no sense how to improve the position of the country. That is their accusation. So they do not like it because we are in a different bhava. But we are trying to change that bhava. The bhava must be there. And the whole Krishna consciousness is meant to purify the bhava. That is stated. Parishuddha bhavaha. We are not negating everything, but we are simply changing from material bhava to spiritual bhava. That's all. So here is a big building. But there are many hundreds and thousands of big buildings in this district or in this country. But here, the bhava is changed. In your country, there may be many big skyscraper buildings. And in comparison to these buildings, this is nothing. He's talking about the Lotus building. But still you have come, spending thousands of dollars here to change the bhava. So that is required. Otherwise, you American boys and girls, you have no business to come here and see this big building. No. To change the bhava, that is required. And that is a very important thing. Getting down from the Vyasasam, the devotees crowded around. Prabhupada embarked on his daily circuit of the temple room. Prataputra Swami struck up a loud kirtan And as Prabhupada began to exhibit his own bhava, dancing up and down the whole time, the devotees went wild with delight as he rang the bells hanging down on either side of the temple room, strongly pulling on the ropes for prolonged spells, and encouraging the devotees to chant and dance with increasing enthusiasm and smiling all the while. After his third circuit, he came before their lordships and he began to dance. Hundreds of devotees converged around him, leaping with excitement as he put first one hand in the air, and then handing his cane to Madhavisa Swami, he raised the other. With both arms extended and a huge smile on his face, he urged the ecstatic crowd to greater and greater heights of spiritual abandon as he jumped up and down enthusiastically. It was a personal demonstration of what Lord Chaitanya's festival is really all about: purification through association. Visiting the Dham is wonderful, but seeing and being with Srila Prabhupada is the concentrated essence. So that was very wonderful. Prabhupada just started jumping up and down and with his arms up and down. Everybody was just going completely mad. It was wonderful. So some more dancing. Prabhupada arrived in Melbourne. Now, Madhavisa, he had been the GBC there for a number of years, from 72 to the beginning of 76. Then he was sent to New York. So when Prabhupada arrived there, Guru Kripa was now the new GBC. Madhavisa was well known for being a very enthusiastic kirtan leader and dancer also. Prabhupada even had once complimented him. He said, "Madhavisa is the emperor of kirtan." So now Prabhupada was arriving in Melbourne without Madhavisa being there. But the devotees were, you know, still chanting and dancing very enthusiastically. So on April the 21st, then Prabhupada was delighted with the report. He had just got a report from Madhavisa in New York. He has great appreciation for Madhavisa Swami's organizational accomplishments, and he replied to him in very endearing terms. "I am here in your temple. I am feeling your separation. But I am seeing everything is going nicely, the same as it was when it was under your management. The devotees here, they are jumping and dancing very nicely." So that was a very nice letter. Then a bit later on, we were in Hawaii. This was the last class that Prabhupada gave there on June the 1st before we set off in the evening for Los Angeles. So Prabhupada was talking from the section about Ajamil, 6.1 verse 33. So it was about the Vishnu Dutas meeting the Yama Dutas. So Prabhupada was saying that in the material world, sex life is the highest pleasure, and in the spiritual world, there is no sex. Then he revealed the secret of how one can conquer material sex desire by experiencing a higher pleasure, thus becoming eligible to enter into the spiritual realm. "So what is that pleasure?" he asked. "That pleasure is this chanting and dancing, Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. That is stated in the Shastra. They are so much absorbed in this chanting and dancing, they are no more interested in sex. That is the only way. If you want to stop the pleasure of sex, then you have to take this pleasure, this transcendental pleasure, and you'll forget everything." It is said by Jamuna Acharya. So he was a very big king, and he had a very good opportunity for sex life. He was a king. But later on he became a perfect Vaishnav, devotee. So after he became a devotee, he was expressing his ecstatic love for Krishna, that "whenever I think of sex with a woman, I spit on it." So, if we want to be freed from the entanglement of this material world, we should practice. Simply artificial practice will not help. Unless we advance in Krishna consciousness, unless we become accustomed to enjoy this ecstasy of chanting and dancing, it is not possible. Variety is the mother of enjoyment. If you want enjoyment, there must be variety. Because we are part and parcel of Krishna, we have got the same quality. So you see Krishna. He is enjoying with the gopis, with the cowherd boys, friends in Vrindavan, in the forest, with the cows, with the calves. So this is enjoyment, variety. Zero is enjoyment? No. zero is not enjoyment. And under my Abhyasat, that is the Vedanta Sutra, that the absolute truth, the personality of Godhead, is simply enjoying. Everything enjoyment. You find Krishna always, wherever he is, he's playing on his flute with company, either the gopis or the cowherd boys or somebody. So this is enjoyment. And he comes personally to this planet to show his enjoyment life of Vrindavan. So that place, Vrindavan. Therefore, Vrindavan is so important to invite us that, why are you not in here? Come with me. Enjoy with my dance. Looking up the beautiful forms of Sri Panchatattva standing before him, their arms raised, Prabhupada smiled. Similarly, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also, you see dancing. Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Sri Advaita Gadadhar, Sri Vasadi, all dancing. So the life is this enjoyment, dancing. That is life, not meditation. 15 minutes meditation, I become God. These are all rascals. Enjoyment is real life. Enjoyment. So that enjoyment, not this material world, this sex. No, above this. Transcendental. Then we find information in Krishna consciousness. That we find. So I'm very glad that you have all taken it. Continue this Krishna consciousness. Read books, chant, dance, eat nicely, and be happy. Thank you very much. That's the essence. Just chant and dance. Now, then the next month, Prabhupada had been invited to Washington, D.C., and that year, 1976, was the 200th anniversary of American independence. So on July the 4th then, the devotees invited Prabhupada to go down into the city, because there was supposed to be some, you know, grand fireworks display, and a million people were supposed to be gathering in Washington Mall there. So Prabhupada agreed. And so we went off in a convoy of about 10 or 12 vehicles. Because Potomac, our temple, it's up in the hills, and you have to go down the hillside to get down into the city. So thinking of the report that we had received previously from Adi Keshava Swami in New York, describing the positive reception of their kirtan party, which travels around New York on the back of a flatbed truck, I observed that a similar arrangement here would be a big success in the slow-moving traffic. So Adi Keshava had written, they had a whole kirtan party, all they did was just drive around New York all day. And they were on an open-sided truck, so they just have traveling kirtan all like that. Prabhupada was very happy with that. And when we went down into the mall to go down into Washington, the traffic was moving really, really slowly because it was just so many millions of people going down there. It was moving, but really slowly. So I thought, you know, if we had a kirtan party, that would be really good. So Prabhupada, that prompted an immediate request from Prabhupada for the devotees to do kirtan. The message was passed to the lead vehicle, which was a large van packed with devotees. They had instruments, and the devotees burst into song, everybody on the roadside turning to look, and many of them waving and chanting and dancing on the roadside as we went past. Prabhupada enjoyed the favorable response. He said that people actually want to chant and dance, but they are artificially suppressing it or being artificially suppressed. So far as I have observed, he said, people here and in the communist countries are not different. The general people are very nice, but they are not being allowed. So it's interesting, that made Prabhupada think about the communist countries. He saw all the people just gathered. Naturally, they were all very jubilant. And that was his observation, that people in communist countries are just the same. It's just bad leadership that's suppressing them from chanting and dancing. So once we arrived in the city precincts, even the policemen began dancing at the sound of the mridangas and kartals, smiling and waving as we passed them on the street corners. Everybody was in a jubilant mood and seemed to take special delight in seeing the Hare Krishnas participate in the celebration. One somewhat intoxicated group that we passed exuberantly chanted the Maha Mantra while carrying 6 packs of beer on their shoulders. Prabhupada laughed to see them, enjoying the tour very much. So that was very nice. So then the next day, because we stayed until the evening, and there was supposed to be this fireworks display, but because it was middle of summer, then of course it didn't get dark until about 9:30. So they couldn't do the fireworks display till really late. So we had stopped at the far end of the Washington Mall, and there was a traffic roundabout, a circle. And people were just, you know, camped out on it. So we stopped, and we got a chair for Prabhupada, and then we were sitting. And then we were going to watch the fireworks display, but it was taking longer and longer. Then when they did start it, they did some kind of ground fireworks display, so you couldn't really see that much. So then we figured, if we stay here until the end, it's going to be 4 o'clock in the morning by the time we get back to the temple, because everybody's going to leave at the same time. So Prabhupada was feeling tired, so we decided to drive back. So we didn't see the fireworks display, just a little bit, not much. But Prabhupada did say that fireworks were Vedic. He said in Vedic times they did have fireworks. So the next day then, on July the 5th, then we got Prabhupada's purport to the event. So Prabhupada went to Great Falls Park again for his morning walk. He was in a lively mood, and in the car he asked what had been the use of yesterday's celebrations. He said the whole concept of being independent was foolish. There could never be any question of independence. Pushyakrishna asked, if there's no independence, then where is the question of anybody taking initiative in the material world? Initiative? What is that question? Prabhupada asked him. Initiative, I understand. But do you think that by taking initiative of independence that you become independent? Just like this, by dancing and fireworks you become independent? This is the initiative, dancing like dogs. He sang a little ditty, making us all crack up with laughter. We are independent, we are independent. Does it have any meaning? Prabhupada said, grinning. Dancing like a dog, that's all. He told us that they were misusing their energy, and he gave a calculation on the cost of the whole production. So he'd read in the newspapers later in the morning, yesterday some 2.5 million the government has spent, and we, the general public, also combined together, we have spent 10 million by power, gas, going there and coming. So all these $13 million spent for nothing. Dancing like dogs. Independence. Just see? Maya. So that was Prabhupada's. He liked to see them dancing to the Hare Krishna mantra, but the other kind of dancing was just dog dancing. So then again Prabhupada brought up the dancing like dogs. This was later on in the year. We were, I think we were still in New Delhi. We'd been there for Radhastami, and then we were going to go to Vrindavan. But one member of parliament came to see Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada, this is on September the 1st, Prabhupada has been active in countering the negative propaganda against him. So when we arrived back in India, it was to find, you know, all this huge propaganda going on in the newspapers that ISKCON is a front for the CIA. Yeah? And even it was so bad that even some of Prabhupada's own godbrothers were saying yes. Otherwise, how did he get all that money? It must have been given to him by the American government. They couldn't believe that, you know, Prabhupada did it all on his own from his preaching. So Prabhupada then was, you know, becoming very active in launching a campaign to counteract, because it actually came up in the Indian parliament. The communist parties were agitating, and they brought questions that who is this ISKCON, what are they doing here, they're all Americans, they're all over India, they're all spies, like this. So Prabhupada had Gopal Krishna Prabhu visit various favorable government officials here in Delhi. At about 11 a.m., Mr. Krishna Modi, a member of parliament, came to see Prabhupada to discuss how to deal with the accusations against us, and as well as the demands for a government inquiry into our activities. So they wanted an official inquiry into ISKCON. Showing Mr. Krishnamurti the declaration by the mayor of San Francisco for Rathiatra Day, Prabhupada told him that 50,000 people come every year. And this time, he said, New York, the government, the police, they appreciated that this kind of dancing, this is not artificial. So we just had the first Rathiatra in New York in 1976, and it was a huge success. So here is life, he said. They appreciated that what the American boys have got to do to dance for Krishna, unless it is from the heart. They're not dancing dogs that I have trained them, and they are dancing. So there are many things to be done in India, but I am, without getting any cooperation, I am getting opposition. Mr. Krishnamurti agreed. Now we must be active. It will be good for the country, for the whole nation, Prabhupada told him. Let us cooperate. You will see how I can change the face of India. Telling him that Krishna consciousness was the only platform on which the real United Nations could be made, Prabhupada described the analogy of the blind and the lame man. So at the present moment, I am trying to spread this movement all over the world, but we have no means. So let the Americans supply money, and let them take our direction for the culture. That will be United Nations. And actually, it will become. How they are dancing, black, white, Indian, American, European, in the Rathiatra. There is no politics. It is out of really spiritual ecstasy. So, that was, Prabhupada was very happy to see the devotees dancing. However, as I mentioned sometimes about chanting, when people started chanting different things that he, you know, from what Prabhupada had given, sometimes Prabhupada would just let it go on. He wouldn't say anything. But then if somebody else came and asked him specifically, what do you think about this, then Prabhupada might express a completely different opinion. You know, by not saying anything, it seems like he's approving. But, you know, it's a question of preference, and sometimes when Prabhupada was asked about certain things, he did actually, you know, sometimes express some negative opinions. So this happened with the dancing. So this was on July the 7th in 1976 in Washington, D.C. So not long after the dog dancing for Independence Day. And then, of course, the devotees were all there. There was, wherever Prabhupada went, they would always get, you know, at least 7 or 8 temples locally that would come. So there would always be a couple of hundred devotees there. So Rupanuga's concern, he was expressing some questions about the way that the devotees were doing kirtan. His concern was about the way that the devotees dance in the temple. He felt it was not proper. Especially during Mangalarti, he said. Is it not that the devotees should not turn their back while dancing to the deity? And Prabhupada agreed with him. No, no. And they should not bump into each other or dance with each other personally, distracting attention from the deity. Shouldn't all the dancing be focused towards the deity? Sometimes dancing is done here in a peculiar method, Prabhupada said wryly. He was smiling, but his point was serious. That is not desirable, he said. The dancing, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is showing. And you have also shown us the changing of the feet with the arms upraised, not with the back to the deity, Rupanuga said. They do it out of sentiment, Prabhupada said, but that is not very good. Also, they bump into each other with the drum, or with each other's bodies. That's not bona fide, is it? Rupanuga asked. It's very popular in our movement right now. They are inventing, Prabhupada said resignedly. What can I do? If you invent your own way. So then, 3 days later, we were in New York. And then this topic came up again. So, there was a newspaper article. And it was being read out to Srila Prabhupada. I think Tamal Krishna Maharaj was reading it. So the article was by Bill Fayle from Durban, South Africa, of the Natal Mercury Reporter, which was quoted in a magazine called Transcendental Meditation Today. So what had happened was that, of course, the people we know as the TMers, they had put a copyright on Transcendental Meditation. So that was being challenged because, you know, they didn't want that any group could have an exclusive, you know, on the word meditation or transcendental. So there was some court fight going on to stop them from making it, you know. So they eventually, I think they copyrighted TM, but not Transcendental Meditation. So these people, they started up a magazine called Transcendental Meditation Today. They weren't from the TM group, they were against them, and just to, you know, stir them, they called their magazine Transcendental Meditation Today. So they had come and they had visited the temple in New York. And so they gave a description. And they'd also read one article by this man in Durban about, you know, Krishna consciousness there in South Africa. So Prabhupada liked the whole article, although there was one description which caused him some concern. Tamal Krishna read out a section describing the evening arati. Quote, "The kirtan begins with the chanting of the Maha Mantra, slowly at first and melodiously. Then the chant will speed up as the spirit of devotion spreads. Often the most rapid and intense chanting is done by a hardcore knot of doted men before the curtains of the shrine." Tamal Krishna added in his own comment, "The devotees get in one group and then they start." He says, "hardcore devotees." And then he read on. "The rhythm approaches that of an express train, and the atmosphere is apt to remind a lay visitor of an old-fashioned football rally. Some of the onlookers try to keep up with the central group, clapping their hands, swaying their bodies, throwing their arms upwards, and amongst the younger, adopting modern dance steps to the rhythm. When the shrine curtains are drawn back, the devotees kneel and press their foreheads to the ground." Prabhupada frowned a little. Who has introduced this peculiar dancing? "It just evolved," I suggested. Rupanuga spoke up. "While we were speaking about that the other day, it's changed from the original dancing that you showed us to something else. It's too much like the modern dancing." And Prabhupada agreed with him. "I think that this is not good." Then Tamal Krishna began to read on and then stopped again. "Well, what way should we dance, Srila Prabhupada? With our arms outstretched? Or sometimes the devotees like to jump around. Is that all right?" "In ecstasy one can do anything," Prabhupada said. "That is another thing. But artificially to do something is not good." "But if one feels like jumping, is that all right?" "Anything artificial is not required," Prabhupada said. "Well, so then running back and forth is not..." No, he said, not wanting to completely condemn them. He obviously didn't want to squelch their enthusiasm. Yet at the same time, he added, "That should not be an artificial show." So, it's interesting, because I sent this quote to somebody who's a bit notorious for introducing new things into kirtan. And I said that, you know, this is Prabhupada's comment, that nothing artificial. And when Tamal Krishna says, "Well, you know, is it all right if they dance and jump?" Then Prabhupada says, "In ecstasy, one can do anything." So then he took it that that means because we're in ecstasy, it's okay to dance and chant. But I pointed out, I said, "No, if you're actually in ecstasy, then you can do anything." But, he said, "That's another. But artificially to do something is not good." And then when Tamal brings it up again, Prabhupada again repeats it. Anything artificial is not good. In other words, Prabhupada didn't accept that the devotees, our devotees, you know, leaping up and down and bouncing off the walls and off each other and all these things was actually a display of ecstasy. Yeah, it was not, I mean, real spiritual ecstasy. It was, you know, tinted with material, you know, modes, maybe Rajagun or Tamagun or whatever. But Prabhupada was actually saying artificial is not required. So he was checking it. Yeah. So if you're actually in real spiritual ecstasy, that's a completely different thing. But for most of us, we're not on that platform of ecstatic love of Godhead. So anyway, that's Prabhupada's opinion about the peculiar dancing. And you can all take it as you like. Okay, so another dancing that we experienced, this was at the opening of the Hyderabad temple. This was on August the 17th in 1976. So in the late evening, now Prabhupada's room is like, it's up on the first floor, but it's on the other side of the temple room wall. And so the devotees have put a doorway in Prabhupada's room with a little balcony which, you know, opened out onto the temple room. So if you were looking at the deities, like, say, in front of you, if you looked upwards and to the left, you'd see this doorway leading into Prabhupada's room. And Mahamsa's idea was that when Prabhupada was in residence, he could come and sit on the balcony, people could see him from down below, and then they could have a few minutes, have their darshan, and then he would go back in, and then they wouldn't have to come up and bother him in his room. Anyway, it was a nice idea, but unfortunately when the temple was opened, they only had the hole, but there was no door, right? Because the temple wasn't finished. So every little sound that was going on in the temple room was coming straight into Prabhupada's room. Anyway, so they had like a curtain. So about 11 o'clock at night, I heard all this chanting going on downstairs. So I pulled aside the curtain. I'd just finished massaging Prabhupada, and I thought, what's going on down there at this time of night? So I pulled the curtain open, and I looked down, and it was to see Lord Jagannath and Balaram and Subhadra come walking into the temple room. So the deities were beautiful, each standing about 3 feet high. They were carved by the same artisan who had made the main deities in Jagannath Puri. As they stood in a line, waiting to be hauled over the balcony balustrades and up into the deity room, the devotees gathered in front of them and unleashed their youthful exuberance. So there was this group of South Indian brahmanas, Sampat Kumar Bhattacharya and his men, and they had come to do the installations. And, you know, they're very typical epitome of, you know, the South Indian brahmins with the big bellies, very fancy, you know, dhotis, gold and everything, big, huge earrings and huge seekers pulled back, you know, big white tilak like this. Very, very nice people. And so they were going to do the installation. So in the night time, they were bringing the deities into the temple room, and then they were going to put them up behind the altar, ready for the next morning ceremonies, you know, for the Abhishek and everything. So they were actually literally walking in Lord Jagannath and Balaram and Subhadra one after another. So they were making them walk. And the devotees were, you know, chanting all around them. So the whole thing was becoming more and more ecstatic. So Lord Jagannath comes in, then Subhadra comes in, then finally Balaram comes in. And as each deity came in, it got more and more and more enthusiastic and louder and louder. Then they lined them up in front of the altars before they were going to take them up into the deity room. So as they stood in the line waiting to be hauled over the balcony balustrades up into the deity room, the devotees gathered in front of them and unleashed their youthful and exuberance. Their enthusiasm for the holy names soon swept up the normally staid middle-aged South Indian brahmanas into its thrall, and they began to clap and sing and dance. As the chanting increased in intensity, one of the visitors, one of the brahmanas, a bearded fellow with long graying hair, abruptly stopped, standing stock still. His body stiffened, and he threw his head back, and he began rocking it back and forth from side to side. Baring his teeth like a big cat, he clawed the air with his outstretched arms, seemingly oblivious to his surroundings. So he was like this, like he was some kind of a lion or something. He remained like in this mesmerized state for several minutes, his eyes widened and unblinking, and as he repeatedly snarled and cleaved the air, our devotees, a bit bemused by his exhibition, nevertheless continued their energetic dancing and chanting. Suddenly, reaching an apparent peak of entrancement, the brahmana fell stunned to the floor. His compatriots quickly gathered around him, and after a minute they helped him to his feet. He was uninjured and still wrapped in the kirtan. The pandits then all abandoned their sedate dignity and wholeheartedly joined in the chanting and dancing, raising their arms and their voices, even leaping high into the air with their youthful hosts. When the kirtan finally ended, the deities were taken into the deity room ready for their installation tomorrow. I found out later that the bearded brahmana is a pujari of Lord Nisringadev in Bangalore. So he got so swept up, he went into the ecstasy of Lord Nisringadev. Because you have to be careful about things like that. Prabhupada said that if somebody, you know, if they sat rolling on the ground and crying and all these things, you know, he was asked one time, how do you know if they're actually in ecstasy? Prabhupada said, just give him a kick in the head. Right? Because he was being sarcastic. Because in India you get so many sahajas. So when I first joined the Krishna Balaram Mandir in Vrindavan, when Prabhupada was visiting there for Jamastami and his Vyasa Puja, then this very large group of villagers, maybe 300 or 400 of them, they turned up to come and see the Angraj Mandir. Angraji means, of course, English. So that was what we would call the English Mandir. So, you know, we'd only been opened a few months. This was 75. So we were just starting. The word was going out. Go to Vrindavan. Go to Ramanreti. Go and see the white sadhus. So all these people came in. They were all milling around. The place was packed out. And we were having, you know, our evening arati. I think Mahaksha was leading. So we used to have pretty ecstatic kirtans. And he was getting right into it. We were all gathered around. We were chanting like anything. And then this young man, he was with these villagers. He started, you know, dancing with us. And then before we knew it, he was starting to spin. And then he had his arms out and he's spinning around like a whirling dervish or like a spinning top. And then all of a sudden, bang, he goes out on the floor, right? He's in ecstasy. So then I saw Rasananda. He was one of our godbrothers. And I saw him. He walked up to him and all the villagers are kind of looking, oh, he's in ecstasy and all this like. We just kept on dancing because it was the first time I'd experienced anything like that and we really didn't know how to deal with it. So we thought, well, we'll just keep on chanting. But Rasananda, he had heard this thing that Prabhupada had said. So he went over and I saw him. He was looking at him like this. He was peering over this boy. He was laid out prostrate on the ground. And then all of a sudden he swings his leg back and bang! It kicks him in the head. And that was it. All hell broke loose. All the villagers flipped out. What's this? He's in ecstasy and this Malecha's kicking him in the head? They couldn't believe it. And then Rasananda grabs him like a sack of potatoes and he starts dragging him out the temple room to get him out the temple room because he thought he was being offensive because he was doing it in front of the deities. So then the villagers, they all jumped, you know, forward, and they grab the boy's legs, and Rasananda's got his arms, and he's stretched across the doorway. Rasananda's trying to pull him out, and they're trying to pull him back in, and there's nearly a riot going on. So anyway, somehow or another, we managed to cool things down, but it took about half an hour. I mean, we were lucky we weren't all killed. And then when Prabhupada heard about it, he said he has to leave Vrindavan immediately. You know, Rasananda. So anyway, when you see these things, just be careful how you respond. Okay, so dancing is for the sudra class, not for the respectable people. So this is more comments about just dancing in general. So this was with George Harrison, July 27th, 1976, in London. And George's visit prompted some talk about artists. Prabhupada explained that in India, the artistic class are considered shudras, not very high-class profession. He said that 100 years ago, Girish Chandra Ghosh tried to introduce theatrical performances with both men and women actors in imitation of the Europeans. So he wanted to invite women artists, so not a single woman joined. Who will go to public stage to dance? A respectable girl. They'll never. So that was 100 years ago. He recalled that even 40 years ago, he knew a respectable family who had rejected the notion of teaching their daughter to dance and sing. So the girl was to be married, he said, and it's the custom in India that the bridegroom's party, they come to see the girl. So whether she is all right. So similarly, the girl's party, they go to see the boy. So they came to see my friend's daughter, and the daughter is very beautiful, and the rich man's daughter. So one of the bridegroom's party, he questioned, "You know how to dance?" So that was the question to the girl. "You have learned something about dancing and singing?" So she was my friend, Mukundamati's daughter. So his elder brother was there, and he became very angry. "This rascal is asking our daughter whether she knows dancing and singing?" He took it as an insult that respectable family, daughter should learn how to dance and sing. So immediately he protested. No, no, no. She does not know how to dance, how to sing. She is not meant for that purpose. We like, of course, a young girl dancing and singing. But we cannot teach to our family members. We spend for that outside. You cannot expect our Mullick's family daughter dancing and singing. So actually dancing and singing, what is this nonsense for a respectable family? It is meant for the low-class professional. So you pay them, they'll dance. Or you go to some prostitute, she will dance. So amongst the theatrical, Girish Chandra Ghosh, he could not get a single response from any respectable family. So then he had to seek some young girl from the prostitute class. So then later on, they became famous artists, Kusumakari Dasi. So nowadays, it has become a fashion that aristocratic families should join the cinema and spoil their character. So there you go. Okay, so we're right at the very end. Just two last little comments about chanting. I hadn't categorized those, so I just dropped them at the end. So in India, sometimes Prabhupada would speak in Hindi or Bengali, but he would always insist that his Western disciples remain and listen. Similarly, once in Bhubaneswar, whilst he was giving a lecture on Bhagavad Gita 7.1, some village people came and they were making a bit of commotion. So the devotees thought to usher them away because there was no chance that they would understand the lecture. But Prabhupada, however, had different ideas. And he said, "Why are they being driven away? You let them sit down. You ask them, sit down. That's all. Let them sit down. They will simply hear. That will also benefit. So let them sit down. Even they cannot understand, if they hear the voice, then they will be benefited." So that's transcendental sound vibration, even if you don't know the language, but it will have a transcendental effect. So that's it. That's the end of the Prabhupada the Living Bhagavatam chanting seminar. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Any quick questions or comments?
Did Prabhupada ever explain why there should be bells hanging in the temple?
Did Prabhupada explain why there should be bells hanging in the temple? It's a tradition that when you enter the temple, you should ring a bell, because it's just politeness. It's just like if you go into somebody's house, you don't just barge in, you knock on the door. So, same thing. You ring the bell, and then the deities know you're coming. It's, you know, out of respect.
Like here, during Dashanati, the bell next to the right amount of the altar is let down when Prabhupada is doing his parikram.
Right.
And then everyone rings it as they serve members of the deities.
Yes.
And it's not there when they enter the temple in the beginning. So
right. Well, we ring the bell that's hanging at the side of Radhamadava's altar on Prabhupada's circumambulation of the altars, because that's how we used to do it. I read that description of him dancing there. Every morning after Prabhupada gave class, then he would get down and then he would circumambulate Radhamadava. In those days, of course, we only had small Radhamadava, and that was in the Lotus building. But there was a bell hanging from either side of the deity room. And when Prabhupada went to circumambulate, he would stop at the bell, grab the rope, and then he'd start ringing it. And then all the devotees would just jump like anything. They'd go wild. And every time Prabhupada went around on either side, he'd stop and ring the bell. And then he would, you know, wave with his hand like this, so the devotees would start jumping. And then on the third one, then he would come and end up in front of the deities. And then he would, you know, not every day, but he would dance sometimes. So that's, we just to maintain that tradition, we when we take Prabhupada's deity around, we give him the rope, and then we pull the bell.
And yeah. At that time, Prabhupada could ring the bell, or all of the devotees would afterwards?
It was mainly Prabhupada, but I think that sometimes, you know, the devotees did also ring it. But it was mainly, you know, it was a thing that Prabhupada did. So, because Prabhupada was doing it, nobody else liked to, you know, assume that they could do it. Any other questions? Or comments? Okay, I think. Yes, bro.
I kind of miss a little bit the point about kirtan dancing. Like sometimes we are not in ecstasy or experience the ecstasy, but we try to, you know, act like we are in ecstasy. So then after we get the real ecstasy.
Well, as Prabhupada said, you can't do anything artificially. There's a difference between following and between imitating. And if you, you know, throw your body here and there and, you know, make out like you're in some kind of spiritual trance, when actually you're not, that's not practicing to become in ecstasy. That's cheating. And it's also, you know, it's imitation. And what will happen is that in your imitation, you'll commit offenses to the deities. Now, somebody who's actually on the platform of genuine ecstasy, he's seeing Krishna at every moment, or he's, you know, he's absorbed in that ecstasy of Krishna at every moment. But it, you know, if we go in and we start dancing and chanting, of course, everybody knows if you, it's just like athletes, you warm up, you get the oxygen flowing, and you get into a heightened state of awareness. If you do a lot of physical exercise, it's, you know, it's not just that because we dance and chant in kirtan. I mean, sometimes we do get a bit carried away and we feel, oh, now I'm, you know, experiencing a bit of ecstasy. But actually you can induce that, you know, just by any kind of physical exercise. If you do it very vigorously, because you get more oxygen flowing. So, you know, the fact that you're feeling like, you know, jumping and bouncing, and it's not necessarily that it's spiritual ecstasy. Because we do it to the Hare Krishna mantra. So that spiritualizes it. Therefore, Prabhupada didn't necessarily, you know, stop devotees from doing it at every time. But as he said, it should not become artificial. And I've seen sometimes that the devotees just get ridiculous. You know, especially now in Gaur Purnima. Last year I saw there was a big kirtan going on. Then about, I mean, everybody was just kind of going wild. And then at one point there was a bunch of brahmacharis, about 10 of them. And they all laid down on the floor. And they all put their feet together, like in the middle, like a cartwheel. Right? And then they, different devotees stood up and they grabbed the hands of the people that were lying on the ground. And then they started running around. I mean, it's just so bogus. It's got nothing to do with, you know, it's got nothing to do with being in ecstasy of dancing for Krishna. It's got everything to do with being in the ecstasy of Rajagun, that's all. You know, just making up things as you go along. There's all kinds of things that they do, you know. It just really gets out of hand. And the way that Prabhupada danced, you know, I mean, it was beautiful. You know, just like Lord Chaitanya with his hands up, you know, one foot forward, then back, the other foot forward, then back, and always, you know, for the pleasure of the deity. But a lot of our devotees, they forget all about the fact that the deities are even there. They get so wrapped up in, you know, screaming and yelling and running here and there and bouncing off the walls and on the floor. And it just becomes too much.
How we can act enthusiastic without being false? Like, we know the story of Vishnu Yan Swami, he was saying that I'm not in ecstasy, but I try to be enthusiastic, and then the devotee becomes...
No, that being enthusiastic, that's nice. You know, you need to be enthusiastic. But getting, you know, to these kind of outrageous performances that some of our devotees start doing, then it goes too much. So the main thing is that if you're always, you know, your attention's on the deity, and, you know, you may jump up and down and, you know, dance around, but as long as your mind's on the deity and you're conscious of the fact that you're doing it for the pleasure of Radha Madhava, then that will, you know, that will check you and stop you from getting too far out. Yeah. But if you forget the deities are even there and you just start getting wrapped up in your own, you know, and usually it's the younger devotees, they just get wrapped up in their own youthful energy and enthusiasm. As I say, it's good that they're doing it to chanting Hare Krishna, but, you know, there's certain boundaries that need to be observed. Just like, at least in ISKCON so far, we haven't had too many people that roll on the ground all over the place. But that may come. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Yes.
When in my early days, when we were in Bhaktivedanta Manor, and then once in the room, Swami came, and because we were all young and all that, and it's a wooden slippery in front of Radha Gopalananda, so we sort of like dived towards the Lord. And
that's
then,
the 100 meter sprint.
That's it.
Right? You just run, and then at the end, you slide on your legs, and then jump up, and then run back. And there's like so many different things.
Yeah, then Maharaj Shivram Swami was around, and he watched us, but again, then he warned us that this should be stopped. This is,
yeah.
This should not happen again.
The 80 yard dash. It gets a little too far out sometimes. Okay, we're going to finish at this point. I think that Nanda Kishore Prabhu is going to make an announcement now. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.